The Queensbridge House public housing project in Long Island City, Queens, is the largest such complex in the country. With more than 7,000 residents, it's a community with little faith in civic engagement. Like other public housing communities and low-income neighborhoods in general, poor people vote at considerably lower rates than wealthier ones. Many feel apathetic, that the system is rigged, and that their votes just don't matter. One nonprofit in New York City is using innovative partnerships with community-based social service organizations to conduct nonpartisan voter mobilization so that more underrepresented citizens can participate in our democracy. Community Votes is trying to change the culture and the mindset of large nonprofit social service agencies so that they integrate into their day-to-day operations civic engagement activities. Such activities include promoting awareness of elections and issues and encouraging voting and other participation in federal, state, and city policymaking. A few years ago, Community Votes partnered with the Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement, a longtime provider of social services in the Queensbridge houses, to engage in personalized messaging to mobilize voters there. The results were a considerably higher rate of voter turnout in the 2014 midterm elections. Joining us to talk about these initiatives is Louisa Hackett, the founder and executive director of Community Votes. Louisa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Louisa, years ago, I think it was nearly 30 years, you and I worked together at the Community Service Society, providing technical assistance to grassroots organizations in New York City. How did you come to form Community Votes?
Heidi, after I left Community Service Society, I went to work for over 20 years with the Community Resource Exchange, also known as CRE. And there I was working one-on-one with hundreds of community-based organizations. And after the crash in the about 8 years ago, most of my work had to do with strategic planning. And all the groups were struggling with figuring out how to serve more people facing greater needs with less resources because there was less government money, less foundation money, less individual donations. And all of these organizations worked in low-income communities. And I wondered how the world or their worlds might be different if these same communities had high voter turnout, because all of them didn't. And I then heard of an organization called Nonprofit Vote, which supports this work nationally. And their premise was work with community-based organizations to help increase voter turnout. And I thought that made a lot of sense. So I tried it out in the city, and we did our first project with Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement House, and it's been expanded since.
So talk a bit, if you will, about the model that you use, because as you say, you involve nonprofit organizations that are already doing community work. Is it okay for them to bring this component into their work? Does it take them away from their mission, for example?
No. In fact, when I had the idea of bringing this work to the city, I interviewed 30 nonprofit leaders, and all of them understood that this would be really a way for them to better achieve their mission, to do more than just deliver services, to actually help empower the people they serve to get involved in policy making. So it actually is very mission aligned.
And tell us how it works. So you have several groups that you work with, and then what do they do?
So I help them identify people within their organizations that are interested in doing this work. I then work with them to identify opportunities where they already interact with the public. So whether it's in waiting rooms, whether it's at their community picnics, whether it's at their parent orientations. Then I train a cohort of staff on how to do nonpartisan voter registration and get out the vote activities. We practice convincing people to talk about why voting is important. We arm them with voter education material so they can answer particular questions about policy issues. And then the staff themselves go out and do the work. The reason the model works is because voter research says really the single most effective way to convince someone to vote is a one-on-one conversation. And nonprofits have thousands and thousands of these conversations a year. They're trusted because they're in the community year in and year out.
The old old-fashioned.
I know. No app.
No app. We're concerned about, and we mentioned this in the introduction, and I've read about it in articles, is that in low-income communities around the nation, including New York, there's a lot of voter apathy, that people feel the system can't change, they can't make a difference. Are your cadres of people sort of instructed on what to say about that, or do you need sort of a pep talk? How do you change that mentality?
Well, it's not easy. First, you can't deny it. You have to find out what people think about it. And if, in fact, they're cynical, you find out why and you find out what they care about. Then you loop back into if they care about stop and frisk or if they care about dangerous streets or if they care about lack of public parks, you then connect to say, well, your local elected officials have discretion over budget dollars, which decide this. Your local mayor hires the police commissioner, which affects what the stop and frisk policies might be. So we find out something that they're interested in and then connect it back to the decisions politicians make.
One thing I was wondering about is in the media, we've heard a lot about allegations that there might be hackers disrupting the elections. Does that kind of thing further erode confidence, in your opinion? Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it yet, but I don't doubt that it will. I think what further erodes sort of cynicism is the lack of competitive elections. So in New York City, for example, in this primary, which we just had on September 12th, the reason we focused on the primary is because that's in a deep blue city. That's where the decision is made. And there were actually only about 10 open city council seats this primary. So we tried to focus on those neighborhoods where there was a competitive election, because come November, it will really have already been decided in terms of those elected positions. That being said, there are a couple ballot questions on the ballot in November, which I think we can draw people to the polls to vote on.
Do you think, Louisa, that people are more cynical about national elections? Do you think you can persuade them that they have more of a say-so in local elections?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. The conundrum is national elections get much more press and attention, and so more people are talking about it and less people are talking about local elections. But when people say their vote doesn't count, when you bring it down to the local election, and particularly a primary election where turnout is so low, increasing turnout by a little bit can make a big difference. So we're trying to make that argument.
Although you could argue that this last national election was an exception with Trump and somebody who was perceived to be a decent guy like Bernie Sanders. But could you argue that that at a local level, if it's a Tweedledum and Tweedledee situation nationally, it could be different at a local level and you could start changing things from the ground up?
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think what's really important is helping people really understand the decision-making power that local officials have, both at the city level and at the state level. And so we've got this most recent election here in the city, 2017, and then we've got the local midterm elections, which will affect who's being elected to go represent them in Albany. So there are many, many opportunities to do that. So the question for the community-based groups is making sure they have enough knowledge to be able to bring that perspective to their participants and the communities that they serve.
Can you quantify the situation? About what percentage of low-income poor people actually do vote in local elections?
Well, I don't know that I can do it just by low income. I know in the local elections, turnout is like in the 20%. And if you go look in particular neighborhoods like the South Bronx or different neighborhoods in Brooklyn, it can be even in the 14%. What's interesting is that voter registration rates are actually pretty high. So, for example, in Queensbridge and Ravenswood, where Jacob Riis works, the registration rates are like 72%. So we quickly, immediately recognize that getting people registered is important. People don't often understand if they haven't voted in 5 years, they're dropped from the rolls. If they change their address, they're dropped from the rolls. Many people don't realize if they've been completed parole, they are able to vote. So this basic information the community groups share, but they quickly realize that we need to focus on voter turnout, because turnout in those, while registration's in the 70s, turnout's in the 20s, so there's this big gap that we're trying to bridge.
And how do you do that? That's a huge gap.
It is a huge gap. So we do it because when they're doing the voter work, they often run into somebody who's registered to vote. So we have them sign an I Pledge to Vote card. These cards have proven in research to increase turnout. So they sign their name and address. The community group then can mail them a reminder card. We also have done two rounds of phone banking. So the New York Civic Engagement Table, who's our critical partner, does training on how to do phone banking. They train the community groups, and they've done two different rounds of phone calls to remind people to vote, as well as posting it on their website and flyers in their lobby.
Louisa, do you have any success stories that you can share, like about an older person or a young person who had no intention of voting but who really did a turnaround?
Well, I can share two, if that's okay. So the first one has to do with the Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement House, who I've mentioned before. Their point person working with community votes was Gwendolyn Wilson, who works at the Senior Center. And as we were trying to figure out who to train to do this work, their executive director said, why don't we focus on seniors? They have time. So Gwendolyn now, over two campaign cycles, has a cohort of senior citizens who are going to do door knocking to get out the vote. They've already done the phone banking to remind people to vote. And this segues into my other story.
How old is Gwendolyn, by the way?
Gwendolyn's in her 50s.
Okay.
I hope that's okay, Gwendolyn.
It's not that senior.
Shared.
Okay.
No, but the
young.
But the people she's working with are in their 80s.
Right, okay. 80s.
They're in their 70s and 80s. But we organized a get out the vote party with some seniors and some high school students. And Mr. Smith, who is in his late 80s, arrived at this party, and he parked his walker outside the door and sat down. And Ms. Maud came. She was the second senior. And Ms. Maud had so engaged the young women. She was high school students. She was explaining that her parents were too scared to vote in the South. And since she moved to New York when she was 20, she hasn't missed one election. And I wanted the young men who were talking to Mr. Smith to switch and talk to Ms. Maud, but the men were young men were like, I want to hear Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith was saying, I'm old now, this is your time, you need to take over this work. And you know, and he asked them what if they knew what the NAACP was. Sadly, they didn't. He then quoted the JFK quote, don't ask what you can do for your country or what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And the young man who was eligible to vote right then and there asked to be registered.
Nice.
So it's just an example of the model is using the assets within the community. It's not volunteers coming
right.
in. It's using the staff and the participants to convince their community members to vote because they have the best.
And that feels really good when you're involved in that.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Changing minds, opening eyes.
Do you ever talk with people about the history of expanding the franchise, securing the right to vote for people who don't own property, or for women, or for black people during the civil rights movement? Because it's so inspiring and so dismaying to see that there have been all these heroic struggles, yet people don't take advantage of them.
Yes, we in our trainings use a 6-minute video from Rock the Vote called The History of Voting that anybody can get on YouTube. And it's an animated history of the struggle for the right to vote back from the colonial days, through slavery, through women, through youth, and it's interspersed with celebrities, and it does the best job, I think, in such a short amount of time to explain.
What's it called again? I want to look it up.
It's called The History of Voting, and it's by Rock the Vote.
Nice. We have just a few minutes left, Louisa. Any plans for expansion or next steps?
Yes, I have been working with umbrella membership organizations of nonprofit organizations. So right now I'm in a partnership with United Neighborhood Houses. They work with 38 organizations throughout the city who in turn reach 750,000 people. So I'm working with their staff so they in turn can support their members. And I have plans to reach additional umbrella organizations in affordable housing, emergency food services, health services. So that's our expansion
plan. Excellent, an ambitious plan.
Yes.
Great. How can listeners learn more about your work?
We have a website, communityvotes.org. There is information there that people can
And can yep. people volunteer if they're interested in
yes,
helping?
Yes, absolutely.
Even if they're not associated with a nonprofit?
Yes.
Repeat that website once more, please.
It's communityvotes.org.
Louisa, on a personal note, if you don't mind sharing, how did you get interested in social justice work?
So probably by osmosis. My father worked in the Kennedy administration, and there was probably many, many conversations around the dinner table about many issues. I do remember him sitting me down in middle school and saying there's two government organizations you need to worry about. That's the FBI and the CIA. And I'm like, what is he talking about? So I had to go look that up. We also were a household that had the Washington Post delivered in the morning and the Evening Star in the evening. And when the Evening Star went out of business, my father said, this is a very sad day because we need to have competition in the news business. It's a good thing. So from my dad, I would say directly.
I think he'd be very proud of you for this,
thank
Louisa.
Thank you, Heidi.
We wish you the best of luck, and we hope to check in after the next round of elections and see how things are going.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder, Louisa. Really appreciate your coming down.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.